Well, good morning, everybody. How are we doing this morning? It's good to see you one last time. Thanks for having me with you this week. It's been a great week for me. Hopefully, it's been a great week for you, and so I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to share with you as we finish out our week together. So it was 5:15 on a Thursday morning, and my wife and I were sitting in the cab of a pickup truck at a gas station, and I was starting to get a little anxious and get a little panicked. About 45 minutes prior, a friend of ours had picked us up at our apartment, and he was taking us to the airport. We were living in Chicago at the time. We lived north of the city in the Vernon Hills area. We were grad students at Trinity, and we were headed home for Christmas. And our friend picked us up, and he was taking us to Midway Airport, south of the city. And somewhere along the way, he realized that his low fuel tank light was on, which made him a little nervous because he wasn't sure how long it had been on, and he was worried, like, will we run out of gas on the way to the airport? So about halfway to Midway, he pulls off the interstate, goes to a gas station, and fills up. And then he comes, after he fills up, after he pays, he gets back in the cab, and he goes to turn on the car, my wife sitting next to him, me squished in that kind of sort of back seat part of a pickup truck, and he can't find his keys. Woe is right. Like, we knew that he had his keys because he had to have his keys in order to get us that far, but he can't find them anywhere. He's checking his pockets. He's checking the middle console. He's checking the side doors. He gets out of the truck, and he starts to walk around the truck. He's looking under the truck. He's looking everywhere, and I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'm sure they're here somewhere. Like, they have to be there. But internally, I'm like, come on, Robert, let's go. Pick up the pace. We got a plane to catch. And he's looking and he's looking. And I'm watching this window of time that we have to get to the airport, like, rapidly shrink. It's 5:15 in the morning. Our flight leaves at 6 a.m. Right? And I'm wondering if you've ever been in a situation like that before. Yeah, we got some people like, oh yeah, I have. Or you've got a place to be, you've got a deadline to meet, and for whatever reason, it seems like time is just clipping away faster and faster than you would like it to move. And you can't do anything about it, can you? You can't hit the pause button, you can't slow down time, and you find yourself thinking, I just need a little more time. Because the unique thing about time is that it might be the most valuable thing that we have, right? Because once it's gone, you can't get it back. Everybody is working with a finite amount of time. You can't add more time, and we don't know actually how much time we do have. It's not like we can stockpile it, we can save it for a rainy day. Time just keeps on moving. And once it's gone, it's gone. Now, sometimes this understanding of time moving fast is situational. Other times, it's existential. So I'm 41. I turned 40 about a year and a half ago. And when I turned 40, it messed with me way more than I thought it would. I just thought it was going to be another day, another year, 40, great. 40s are the new 30s. I was looking forward to my 40s. But all of a sudden, when I hit 40, I'm like, I can still remember being 20. 20 seems like just yesterday. In fact, I still think sometimes I'm 20. And in another 20 years, I'm going to be 60. After that, five more, and I'm 65. If I'm even lucky to have that much time, and I found myself thinking, like, where do I want to be when I'm 60? Like, where do I want to be financially? Where do I want to be relationally? Where do I want my health to be, right? So, like, I just immediately, like, I got to go see the doctor. And there was nothing wrong, but, like, whatever the doctor tells me to do, I'm going to do because I still want to be healthy because time is slipping away. So it raises the question, what are we doing with the time that we do have? So at this gas station, I'm counting down rapidly the amount of time that we have, and it's slipping away to get to the airport in time. And after a few minutes of searching, my friend Robert goes, ah, I found them, found the keys. They had slipped between the door and the seat in that little crack. He picks him up, he turns the car on, he's like, hey, what time does your flight leave? And I'm like, 6 a.m. And he says, oh, Like, it's just then he's realizing for the first time how little time we have. And all of a sudden, his urgency kicks in and he speeds to the airport. So we get to Midway, and now it's like, you know, 5:30, 5:40, and I'm thinking, maybe, just maybe, we can sprint through security and get to the gate in time. And this is when you couldn't check in the night before. You couldn't print off your boarding pass the night before. There were no phone apps that all you had to do was scan. You had to go to the desk. You had to get your ticket. You had to check a bag, and then off you go. So we walk into Midway Airport hoping and praying, and it is a zoo. I mean, it's holiday traffic a few days before Christmas. The line to check in zigzags through the terminal. It actually wraps around the back of the check-in desk, and it goes down this hallway, and we're flying Southwest, and they have all of these attendants all over the place guiding traffic, and they are as chipper as can be. Good morning. How are you? It's a great day to travel. I'm like, I just want to get to the gate on time, right? And I'm freaking out. And so we get there, we get our ticket, we run through security, we get to the gate, the boarding desk, and they're like, oh, we just closed the door. And once you close the door, you can't reopen it. And the first thing that came to my mind was, Robert, why didn't you get gas the night before, right? Why weren't you ready? Why weren't you prepared? And as we move to the last part of Romans 13, Paul is essentially saying the same thing. He's asking us the question, are you ready? Are you prepared? Because time is short. And are you ready for what's to come? And you might be asking yourself, well, ready for what? Like, what is it that I need to be ready for? And that's exactly what Paul addresses the last part of Romans 13. This is Romans 13, starting in verse 11. He says, and do this. You're like, well, do what? He'll get there. And do this, he says. Hold that in your mind, though. What is it he wants us to do? Maybe star that, circle that, underline that. Do this, he says. Understanding this present time. So in this last section of the chapter, Paul is drawing his reader's attention to the reality of time. But he's not talking about time in terms of sequential time. He's not talking about time in terms of, you know, it's Friday, June 29th at 10 o'clock in the morning. He's talking about time in a different sort of way. He's talking about time in two vantage points. One is what he says here, the present time. But again, it's not actually a date on a calendar, but rather he's saying, understand. Understanding this present time, calling our awareness of our current reality, saying understand the world that you live in, understand the culture that you live in, understand what's going on in our world, which raises the question, what is this present time for us? How are we in Wisconsin, 2023, supposed to understand this present time? Now, there's lots of the ways you can think about what's happening in our world. You can think about it politically. You can think about it economically. You can think about it in terms of what's happening technology-wise, you know, coming off the heels of the pandemic. Are we going to face a recession? We can think about it in all different ways. But I want to share a song with you, lyrics from a song. It's one of my favorite bands, a band called Guster from the Northeast, a band that I've seen a bunch of times, just a great, fun, unique sound of a band. And they have a song called Hang On. And I want to share just a minute of this song with you because I think the lyrics of this song capture what's going on for many people. And they kind of use this analogy of life as a story, that we are characters in a story, and that kind of guides the lyrics of this song. So go ahead, we're going to listen to a minute of this song. second chorus, or the second verse of this song says, if we fell inside a forest, would it make a sound? It doesn't seem there's anyone around. Days are long, we carry on, but still don't understand. We're a million miles away. And it paints this picture of where characters in this story, there's an author to this story, but we don't know who the author is. And we don't know how this story is going to play out. And the best that we can hope for is just to hang on in the midst of the unknown. Once you get to the end of the song, it kind of repeats that refrain, hang on, hang on. When all is shattered, and when all your hope is gone, who knows how long? Just hang on. Now, on one level, you say, oh, maybe that's a song of courage, but in my estimation, it's a song of hopelessness. It's like somebody looking for answers, but they have no answers. Like, we don't know the greater meaning of life. We think that maybe there is some greater being out there, because how could all of this get here without that? But who knows who that is? We don't know the one who's written the story that we're in, and we just hang on. A scholar named Michael Bird from Australia has this quote. This is a picture of it. It sits next to my desk because I think it captures the reality for many people. It says, for many people today, their biggest problem is not their sense of guilt. All right, we live in a world where we sometimes assume what people want is an answer to their guilt. And we think that the gospel gives an answer to their guilt, which it does. But most people aren't walking around carrying a sense of guilt in the world we live in today. Rather, he says, their biggest problem is a sense of hopelessness. They have no hope. They don't know the author of the book. They don't know the story that they're in. They're floundering. They're wandering. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for significance. They're turning to all of these other things, and they have no sense of hope. And all they're doing is at best hanging on. I think that captures the reality for many people. A hopelessness, a despair. And what we have is the greatest hope. Because we know the story we're in. We know how the story ends. We know the author of the book. And he has come to us to set us free and redeem us. So in one vantage point, Paul is talking about time in terms of this present time, but from another vantage point, he's talking about time within the notion of future time, which is a little bit more subtle in this passage. Because I would submit through the overall scope of the Bible, the people of God are future-oriented people, meaning we are always looking forward. If you go back to the Old Testament, the people of the Old Testament were always looking forward to the day that the Messiah would come. They're waiting for the Messiah. They're looking to the future. We now, as followers of Jesus, are doing the same. We are looking towards the future when Jesus will return to make all things right, to make all things whole. And so we are waiting, but we are looking forward to the future. Now, the New Testament, when it talks about the future, and it talks about it within the language of time, it often uses the term hour, H-O-U-R, to describe future time. You see that in Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, Jesus is teaching his disciples the day before, a few days before he goes to the cross, and he says this. This is Matthew 24, 44. So you also must be ready, he says, because the Son of Man will come at an hour in the future when you do not expect him. Jesus says the same thing in John 8. He's teaching in the temple. He's teaching the crowds. He's saying things there that are disturbing the Pharisees. They want to arrest him. They want to kill him. And this is what we read in John 8, verse 20. He, being Jesus, spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts near the place where the offerings were put. Yet no one seized him because his hour, which is a future reality, had not yet come. So one way the future gets named in the New Testament is in terms of the hour that we're waiting for. But notice what Paul says here in reference to using the term hour. Verses 11 again, he says, and do this, understanding this present time, the hour has already come. Which might lead you to think he's saying the future you've been waiting for is here. But then he says this, the hour has already come for you to wake up. Anybody fallen asleep yet? Anybody sleeping on me yet? Wake up, he says, from your slumber, because the thing you're waiting for actually isn't quite here yet. It's on its way. Now, if you're in a situation where you're waiting for something in the future, and you know that it's coming, and you know that its arrival will be soon, what starts to happen internally? You get excited. You start to expect it. It's like kids on Christmas morning, that last week before Christmas Day, like the energy of our household just seems to rise. More presents start to appear under the tree. They're like, how many more days left? How many more days left? And then you get to Christmas Eve evening and they're like, I can't sleep. I'm so excited. Tomorrow we get to open presents. You have this anticipation. You have this expectation. You're hoping that the thing you've been waiting for all year, Christmas morning, is finally on the cusp of reality. Paul is challenging the church to wake up, to get ready, not for Christmas morning, but the thing that you're waiting for is on its way. And it raises the question, well, what is that thing? It says, wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. See, Paul is saying, understanding this present time, understand this present time, and his call for the church is to wake up, because his concern is this. His concern is that instead of understanding the present time, we would grow comfortable with the present time. We would start to be comfortable, so much so that we would settle in and curl up to this present time. I know a guy who tells this story about one of his friends who owned a snake. Anybody seen any snakes this week? We've seen a couple. Yeah, some people love snakes. If my wife were here and she saw that picture, she would run out of the amphitheater. She hates even the sight of snakes. And this guy had a pet snake, a big boa constrictor or whatever. And he used to take his snake out. He would put it around his neck. He would put it next to him on the couch and watch movies with his snake, right? Uh-uh. Not for me, not today, not today, Satan, right? So he tells the story of one day he's laying in bed watching a movie and he's got his snake next to him, and his snake starts to do something he's never seen his snake do before. Usually he curls up, but his snake starts to stretch out. And he's just like getting really long next to him, and he's like, that's weird, I've never seen that before. And he starts thinking, maybe I should like call somebody and ask, like, this just seems like really unusual behavior. And so he calls the vet and he says, hey, I'm seeing my snake stretch out. I've never seen my snake do this before. He's just starting to look really weird and different. And the vet's like, okay, tell me about your snake. Tell me what kind of snake you have. How big is it? Okay. So you need to slowly move out of your room. And you need to close the door. Because that snake is starting to size you up to see if it could eat you, to see if you will fit inside his body. Because sometimes, he says, we get comfortable with the things that could kill us. And in this present time, if we're just cozying up with this present time and not realizing we are called, like we said earlier in the week, to be distinct from the world, we could cozy up with things that could ultimately kill us and destroy us. When we give in to the ways of the world, Paul's concern is, are we growing relaxed when we should actually be getting ready? Are we growing relaxed when in actuality we should be getting ready? And why should we be getting ready? He's saying your salvation is on its way. See, Paul is saying that salvation is a future reality. It's on its way. It's not quite here yet. But what does that mean for us in the here and now? See, Paul adds another layer of depth to this sleeping and waking metaphor. He says this in verse 12. The night is already over. The day is almost here. Now, when do you usually wake up from sleeping? Like, this isn't a hard question, everybody. I know it's late in the week. Morning, right. Whew, we did it. That was a hard question. We got the answer. You usually wake up from sleep in the morning. But if you wake up early enough, like let's say you wake up and your clock says 4:30, what do? You typically go back to bed, right? Why? Because you look outside and it's still dark outside, but wait a minute, it's actually morning. We would say it's 4:30, not at night. We would say it's 4:30 in the morning. And if you maybe wait just a little bit longer and you go outside and it's 5, you might start to see something like this, depending on the time of year. Right? You can see the moon, which we associate with the evening. You can see the stars, which we associate with the evening. But what do you see on the horizon? You see light. You see the sun starting to peek its head. You don't even necessarily see the sun. You just see the light from the sun. You have this evidence that morning is on its way, but it's not yet fully here. And see, what Paul is saying is that we live in this place. We live in this kind of transition moment in the overall scope of redemptive history. Because some ways you could say salvation works the same. It's on its way. It's coming, but it's not yet fully here. It's here in that Jesus obtained salvation for those who put their confidence in him when he died on the cross, right? And everyone has this sense and this need of salvation. Like, even if we don't articulate it in Christian terms, everybody has this sense, like, I need something in my life bigger than myself. Like, go back to the Guster song, right? Like, we're in this story, and we have this sense that there's somebody bigger out there who's writing this story, but we don't know who it is, and we need them because we're stuck, it says. We're stuck without a captain or a chart. And we don't know. We don't know how to navigate the course. We need somebody, but we're stuck without a captain or a chart, and the best we can do is hang on. It's like our world has this overall sense that we need someone to give us guidance, direction, and ultimate salvation. And the evidence that we have as Christians that our salvation has been secured for us is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Amen? Because without the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the cross is pointless. Paul says so. 1 Corinthians 15. He says, without the resurrection, like, we as Christians are the most to be pitied. Because our faith is useless. If Jesus proclaimed to be this Messiah who is going to save the world, but died on a cross at the hands of the Romans, was buried in a tomb and stayed dead, big whoop, so what? But by coming back from the dead, it shows that he has power greater than death. Death is the great equalizer. We will all die. It's inevitable. Because of sin in this world, the wages of sin is death. We will all die. But we have hope in Jesus because he has defeated death. The thing that is, for most people, the scariest reality of this world, we no longer have to fear because Jesus has defeated it. And because we are found in him, we too are victorious over the greatest power perceived in our world, which is death. So Jesus has secured our salvation, both on the cross and the resurrection, but it's not yet fully here. Because when you look out at this world, like, it is a big, colossal mess, a huge mess. It doesn't take but 5 minutes looking at CNN to get depressed, right? It's like, oh, like, this is the world we live in. It's painstaking at times. Our salvation has been secured. It is here, but it's not fully arrived. It's still on its way. And so we live in this tension of the already, but not yet. We already have it, but it's not yet fully here. And what Paul is saying is how we are called to live in this tension is basically we are called to put on Jesus. He goes on to say this. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave decently, as in the daytime, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery,
not in dissension and jealousy. Which might make you think what Paul is after is moral conformity. Like, just keep your nose clean. Be a good person. Minimize the bad things that you do. Maximize the good things that you do. Just be out there trying to be a good moral person. But that just doesn't that doesn't cast vision for salvation. All that does is cast vision for behavior modification. And Paul isn't talking about behavior modification. He's talking about being a completely new person. Be transformed, he says, by the renewing of your mind. Don't just try a little harder to be a nice person. Jesus didn't come and die to make bad people good. He died to make dead people live, right? So it's not about just being a good person. It's about being a whole new person. And he uses the metaphor of putting on clothes to describe what it means to put on Jesus. Rather, clothe yourself, he says, with the Lord Jesus Christ. And do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. Now, if you're going to put on new clothes, oftentimes you first have to take off your old clothes. Like, what if we at camp every day, we like put on our clothes for that day, just started to put them on top of the clothes we wore the day before, right? Maybe if you're here in the winter, that's a good strategy. But in the summer, not so much. Like if I started wearing, just next day, put on a new t-shirt. I got 5 t-shirts. And I'm like, yeah, this is what I wore the other day. This is what I wore the day before that. Like you would think I was a fool if every day I walked up here with a new t-shirt on over the t-shirts I wore the day before. The call is to first take off the old. He said, there is an old person in you. That you're not the same person. Once you accept Jesus, you're not the same person you were even the moment before. When Jesus is in your life, when the Holy Spirit comes and fills you, you're not the same person. But sometimes we behave like that old person. So he's saying, distance yourself from that person. Take off that old person and put on Jesus. He says, this is what it looks like. Let no debt remain outstanding, except the continuing debt to love one another. That's the call. That's the call of our faith. If you want to simplify our faith in its most basic terms, Jesus says this himself, love one another. Paul goes on to say, for whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. Now, the law here refers to the Old Testament law. Anybody know how many laws there were listed in the Old Testament? Any Bible whizzes here? 613, right? 613, over 600 laws, and one of them fulfills all 613. Love. Love one another as yourself. The commandments, you shall not covet, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, and whatever other commands there may be are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Essentially, what Paul is saying is that this present time needs people of love. This present time needs people of love. And he quotes Jesus' famous saying, love your neighbor as yourself. The call is to be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that ultimately you can be a person of love. All of this in view of God's mercy. God's mercy is that he was kind to you when maybe kindness wasn't evident in your life. He loved you even though you didn't love him back. He pursued you even though we ran away from him. His mercies are new every morning. And in view of that, be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you can love your neighbor. Now here's the good thing, the good news about being engaged and participating in the mission of God. We are all called to be missionaries. Did you know that? It's not just the Fort staff who are missionary staff who are called to be missionaries. Each one of us here are called to be missionaries. We are called to be sent on mission. And the mission that we're on is to love our neighbors. Good news, how many people here live in a neighborhood? Right? Yeah. If you live in a house somewhere, even if you live in the North Woods, you have neighbors. They might be a little bit further away than the people who live in Wauwatosa next to me, but you have neighbors. You don't have to go far. You don't have to go to the other side of the world. You just go right next door. Just go down the street and love your neighbors well. I want to start to wrap up by showing you a video. There's a guy named Steve Hartman. He does these great videos, these great stories for CBS News. And he does them weekly. And you can just go on YouTube. And if you're ever depressed, like, go search Steve Hartman and you'll get like a dose of encouragement right away. But he's got a great story I want to show to you about what it means to, in a simple way, love your neighbor. Go ahead and take a look.
For most of us,
come in.
Being a good neighbor means loaning a stick of butter. Maybe the occasional social visit.
Hello.
How are you, Kathy?
But Kathy Felt of Sandy, Utah says whatever your standard, it pales compared to what her neighbors did for her.
What was your reaction?
I cried. Just like now. I was so moved. It's my miracle.
Kathy's miracle began about 10 years ago. Her MS had progressed to the point where she couldn't even get into bed. And since she lived alone, the only logical long-term solution seemed to be a nursing home. Until, one day, the guy next door came over and presented Kathy with a list. A list of about 60 men from the neighborhood who were willing to come over.
Hi, Kathy.
In teams of two to put Kathy to bed.
Take off her slippers, take off her socks.
One guy gets on one side and one guy gets on the other side.
Three.
Lift her up, put her on the bed.
It's a process.
You gotta have a pillow under this foot.
Things need to be just so.
She finally says, I feel good.
Perfect.
Pull the covers up.
And she's tucked in for the night.
We leave the kiss out.
Yeah, good, okay.
Kathy's two sons and an aide help her in the morning. But this nightly ritual has been going on 7 days a week.
Good luck, Kathy.
For 10 years now.
We're going to be here as long as she needs us.
Keith Pugmire is the main organizer.
Our challenge is to get everybody a time.
Wait. You've got more volunteers than you need?
Yeah.
What kind of neighborhood is this?
This is a great neighborhood.
Clearly.
There's some houses for sale. You want to move in?
Before you call a realtor, though, one caveat. When Keith first started soliciting volunteers, he says not everyone was a natural Florence Nightingale.
I can't say I was excited. I'll tell you that.
Coming into somebody's home, it's a woman.
And I have no health care background at all.
Here's that. Here's your phone.
There was definitely an evolution. And it was most evident in this man.
Did you want to do this?
His name is John Keller.
No.
John now admits the only reason he agreed to help Kathy was because he knew he would look bad if he didn't.
That's hard for me to say. I had always considered myself a good person, Christian. Then I realized maybe I'm not. I wanted to be a better person.
Today, John says the simple act of lifting Kathy week after week has made him a profoundly better person. A good reminder that burdens are sometimes blessings in disguise.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, anytime.
If we're honest, sometimes loving people is hard. And it's uncomfortable. It's really simple to say, yeah, love your neighbor as yourself, right? But sometimes it means we have to step into things that are uncomfortable. Sometimes it means we have to step into things that are awkward. But man, what a witness to the world when we do that. Because then people are like, why? Why would you do that? Like, why would you go into a stranger's home with no medical training and put her to bed at night? Simple answer, because of what Jesus has done for me. What Jesus has done for me. In view of God's mercy, in view of God's compassion, in view of God's love, we are called to be people of love. Because in the same way that we said earlier, the resurrection bears witness to us that our salvation is coming, it is we, as followers of Jesus Christ, who are called to be people of love, to bear witness to the world that a new reality is coming. I was talking to Keith earlier yesterday, and I said to him, like, I don't think people today are going to be convinced to put their faith in Jesus because of some sort of logical argumentation that we have. Not that apologetics isn't important, but what I think the world is wanting to see is, do we live what we say we believe? If we say that Jesus is a God of love and Jesus has loved me even in my worst, and that we are called to love other people, do they see that? One of the reasons why pastor scandals are so detrimental to the church's witness is because, like, the guy you're following doesn't even, like, believe and follow what you say you believe, then why would I want to? I think we are living in a time, understand, this present time, he says, we are living in a time that people need to visibly see that we have been changed, that the love of God has made us new, and it's working in and through us to give of ourselves at times for the sake of other people. And so, may you see that the mercies of God are new every morning. May you see that what this present time needs most are people of love. May you have a strong sense of urgency and alertness for what's to come. And may you be ready when our salvation does finally arrive, being clothed with the love of Christ for a broken world. Let's pray.